Hello and welcome. I'm Professor Rab Houston of the University of St Andrews in Scotland, and you're listening to one of my series of podcasts called The Voice of the Mad in Britain Between the 17th and the 20th Century. This is the third of five podcasts which is designed to explore how patients coped with being in asylums. The patient in the document that you may have seen on the website was a well-off London lawyer called Merivale, who was at the time of his admission to a private asylum in his mid-30s. You'll hear more about him next time. The document, which I've summarised and reproduced on the website, is typical of a class called Asylum Admission Petitions. These survive in their tens of thousands from the early 19th century until the mid-20th century. Alongside doctors' case notes, they are at the core of most academic research on asylums and mental disorder in the 19th century. Most medical records in public archives are, however, closed to researchers for 100 years after they were created. You might remember from the very first podcast that was focused on documents. That was about the 17th century vicar George Tross, that he was committed to a private madhouse at Glastonbury in the 1650s, after his family asked the owner to come and assess his mental state. The way Tross was admitted was both normal and perfectly legal. Over time, more formal safeguards developed. Since 1774, committals to private asylums had usually been accompanied by medical certificates of one or two physicians. Doctors issuing these certificates of lunacy often simply authenticated what family and servants had told them. Only when inside the asylum were case notes kept on patients, which charted, often in great detail, the lives of patients and the treatments they received. And you can read Merivale's case notes online, if you like, at the website of the Wellcome Trust. The document shows us some other important aspects of how madness was identified and treated in the 19th century. Appearance, demeanour, and a lack of social interaction were as important as some of the more alarming indicators of mental imbalance, such as attempted suicide, or delusions, or vitiated judgment. The erroneous belief that one had committed some awful crime and were to be judged for it was common to many sufferers from mental disorders in the past. What's striking to me about the medical certificates in the document on the website is just how cursory the interaction between practitioner and patient seems to have been. While alluding to depression, suicidal tendencies, and delusions, the two medical men seem to have relied much more on accounts given by servants and family than they do on the admittedly rather uncommunicative object of their consultation. Probably chosen specially to watch over him in case he harmed himself, Merivale's servant seems to have accompanied him to the private madhouse where he ended up, which was Ticehurst. The servant or attendant seems to have provided much of the background report included in the case notes. He must also have afforded much of the personal care and some aspects of any medical or psychological treatment that Merivale received before he entered Ticehurst. Psychiatric nurses like this were usually called attendants or keepers or sometimes servants until the 20th century. The reliance on the personal testimony of those close to the patient is far from unusual in such documents, which effectively authenticated a decision taken by family and friends that the person needed the care that an asylum could give. What's more, judging by appearances was an important part of assessing state of mind, in an age when how one looked was an important indicator of rank, condition, and capacity. For centuries, appearance had been both an indicator and, in some circumstances, a proof that someone was disordered or impaired. What's different about the 19th century is that scientific theories emerged around the relationship between the brain and its receptacle. Some doctors claimed to be able to read skulls for telltale signs of the physical generation that they believed accompanied behavioural abnormalities. This was called phrenology, and while now wholly discredited, it commanded credibility in both scientific circles and the popular mind during Victorian times. People were judged by what was usual for someone of their sex, social class, and age. That conditional judgment is carried into the comments about Merivale's lack of interest in activities normal to someone of his social position, such as billiards and chess. Merivale was a very prosperous man, and Ticehurst only catered for the well-bred and the well-heeled. In a pauper asylum, a public lunatic asylum, the comparable pursuits might have been skittles and draughts. As well as providing for care and cure, asylums of the Victorian age replicated social distinctions within their walls. Clinicians would probably regard Merivale as suffering from severe depression, characterised by lack of pleasure in anything, early awakening, and either apathy or agitation. Patients really do slow down when severely depressed, both in their mental processes and physical movements. Supervision over the care of the person and of the property of lunatics and idiots, which were the terms used in the 19th century, had for many centuries rested in the Crown, whose responsibilities were carried out in practice by the Lord Chancellor. You might remember an example of the formal legal process of identifying incapacity and appointing guardians from the case of Alice Hill a few weeks back. Not until the Lunatics Care and Treatment Act of 1845 were all asylums placed under a national supervisory regime, comprising 5 lay, 3 legal, and 3 medical commissioners. These are the commissioners in lunacy who authorised the removal of Merivale from one private madhouse in the south of England to another. Until the early 20th century, those with means were expected to provide privately for their mentally ill relatives, or in Merivale's case, for himself. Public asylums, which started being built in numbers from the 1840s, were primarily for paupers. The defining issues around admission to different types of asylum were therefore the social status and finance of the person, as much as his or her symptoms and the way they were treated. The 19th century was very much concerned with hereditary causes of both good and bad aspects of personality. that's referred to in the document on the website. The reference to epilepsy is because Ticehurst, and probably also Fawley Cottage, avoided taking patients who were dangerous to themselves or to others. The same was true of another private madhouse where Merivale had spent some time. Dr. Thomas Harrington Tuke was part of an Irish Quaker family who ran a madhouse at Manor Farm House, Chiswick, in West London. Like Ticehurst, it had a very high staff patient ratio. From the census of 1851, we can learn that the Tukes had 5 female nurses, 5 male servants, a cook, a housemaid, and a laundress to look after 5 elderly female patients and 8 mainly elderly male patients. In stark contrast, most public asylums had a staff-to-patient ratio of about 1 to 10. These upmarket private madhouses clustered in London and the home counties, though they can be found scattered all over England and Wales and Scotland. Now that document is useful because it allows us to see what others thought of Merivale. But Merivale was unusual because he wrote and published an account of what it was like being in Ticehurst private madhouse. Please join me next time for an insight into how he himself saw the experience of incarceration which was initiated by the document that's on the website. Thank you for listening.